Welcome to the Invest with Clarity podcast, where you will learn how success in investing, as in life, is the result of absolute clarity. Mark Pearson of Nepsis in Minneapolis, Minnesota, shares his passion for portfolio management and commitment to transparency and communication to allow investors to fully understand what they own and why, bringing them to clarity in their investments. And now, here are your co-hosts, Matt Halloran and Mark Pearson.
Hello and welcome to another Invest with Clarity podcast with Mark Pearson. Today we are going to talk about a very hot, emotionally charged issue, which is bias, who me? Now, Mark, this is part of something that you do annually, correct? Why don't we just cite our precedent here and where this philosophy or where this podcast idea came from?
Sure. So, yes, we do we have a white paper called Biased Who Me, and we update it annually. It's a response to the annual Dalbar QAIB study that comes out each year. And, of course, the Dalbar study it's a quantitative analysis of investor behavior.
Okay, of investor behavior. Okay. Good.
And so, looks at, as you know, at Nepsis, we focus a lot on the psychology and the behavioral characteristics of investors, and we put this paper, white paper, out each year.
One of the things that we were talking about as we were preparing for the podcast really is the kind of thinking that you break down in this, and there were a bunch of categories. Would you mind walking us through what the white paper categories are?
Sure. So basically, what the white paper does is it goes through the Dalbar study, gives data from the Dalbar study, gives some examples of expectations versus reality, the lag between expectations and reality. It talks about the different biases, behavioral biases that investors have. It also talks about tips for advisors on how to manage through some of that kind of stuff and gives some advice about how advisors must take action before, you know, these kind of emotional events end up happening. Because at the end of the day, Matt, as you know, many investors use the exact wrong comparisons for their portfolio and their performance.
Well, let's talk about what those. Yes, I and thanks to you, my eyes have been opened even wider to all of that. But you rattled off what those emotional biases are. And I think it'd be good for our listeners to at least hear what they are, because they're going to be applicable to the rest of the podcast.
Yes. Okay, so the first one is loss aversion. This is the fear of loss, and it leads to a withdrawal of capital at the worst possible time, also known as panic selling. Narrow framing is making decisions about part of the portfolio without considering the effects on the total portfolio. Remember, we always talk about every position in the portfolio is owned for a specific reason, mm-hmm. right? Anchoring. This is the process of remaining focused on what happened previously and not adapting to a changing market. Mental accounting, separating performance of investments mentally to justify success and failure. I see all these all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Lack of diversification, believing a portfolio is diversified when in fact it's highly correlated pool of assets. Now, I often say, as you know, Matt, I argue diversification is different than asset allocation. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are actually over diversified, as it says here, highly correlated pool of assets. And I think asset allocation is a better description of that, meaning we are asset allocating. We own U.S., international, emerging markets, small, mid, large cap, so on and so on. We can talk more about that later. Herding. Following what everyone else is doing leads to, quote, buy high, sell low. Regret. Not performing a necessary action due to the regret of a previous failure. One of my favorites, media response, Uncle Matt. The media has a bias to optimism to sell products from advertisers and attract readership. No. Optimism. This is the last one. Overly optimistic assumptions tend to lead to rather dramatic reversions when met with reality. Those are the biases.
part of investing with clarity, as you have said before, is knowing what you own and why you own it and sticking to your knitting. Yeah, I'm quoting you directly there for podcast upon podcast. Now, when you first started in the industry, let's go back to 1998, because you told a great story when we were getting ready for the podcast about Berkshire Hathaway and the S&P, because I think it illustrates almost all of those flipping biases, doesn't it?
Without question. For those who would remember back 1997, 1998, it was really the advent of the index mutual fund. And back then, there wasn't really ETFs for that. It was all mutual funds. And the media was, you know, pressing hard for people to invest in the S&P 500. And I see a lot of similarities to that happening today. Now, the S&P is not trading at the valuation it did in 1999 or 2000, which I'll cover in a second. But I see the beginnings of that right now as the herd mentality, right? Herding, follow what everyone else is doing, leads to buy high, sell low, as people are herding it to the S&P 500 index because they're being told that money managers don't beat the S&P 500 and blah, blah. You know, you've heard all that, I'm going to call it blatantly crap before. The only benchmark, by the way, should be, are you on track to have the financial future you want to have? So anyway, back in 1998, I remember specifically sitting down with someone, and he didn't say the S&P 500, but he said one mutual fund. If I couldn't outperform the Janus 20 mutual fund, which I think the year before was up like 25% or was up year to date, then 25, whatever. It was a ridiculous performance. It had great performance. Why should he put his money with me? And I said, you're absolutely right. You shouldn't. Why don't you just go ahead and do what you think is best? And of course, the Janus 20 fund actually became one of the worst performing funds over the next 10 years. And like we tell people when they look to Nepsis, knowing what you own and why you own it, or having the ability to understand what you own and why you own it, allows you to make better investment decisions, right? Gives you that clarity. Because what he didn't realize was how the returns were garnered in that fund. Of course, I did, which was all high growth, high large cap tech bombastic stocks that eventually cratered in 2000 to 2002 during that famous 42% pullback in those 3 years. Now, the irony of that is that in 1998, from 1998 until March of 2000, the peak of the market, at that time, the S&P 500 was up about 28%. At the same time, believe it or not, Berkshire Hathaway was down 38%.
Oof.
And I remember those days, people talking about, has Warren Buffett lost it? Has Warren Buffett lost his mojo? And the data points I'm citing to you here come from an AAII article, American Association of Individual Investors. And people can get a link to that if they go to Facebook, Nepsis Inc.'s Facebook page, Matt. They can click on yesterday's radio show and pick it up. But the gist of this article said, this is what really ticks me off. They were talking about had he lost his mojo. And the article says this: there are hundreds of books on Warren Buffett and thousands of books on how to get rich trading. But what's lacking are books that focus on the stumbles that the best investors faced along the way. We tend to put people like Warren Buffett on a pedestal with everybody wanting to know what his secret is. How did he amass an $80 billion fortune? Buffett's real secret is superhuman discipline. From June 1998 through the middle of March 2000, the S&P 500 gained 28%. Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway lost 38% over the same period. Now, you're going to love this. The next line says, sticking with your knitting while going through this type of relative drawdown cannot be learned from reading a book. People want answers and shortcuts with this, which, Matt, let me say that again. People want answers and shortcuts, even though they would be much better off understanding that Buffett makes mistakes just like the rest of us. So was he implying that Buffett was down 38%? That was a mistake? Because I would argue that that's less than 2 years of long-term investing. That does not constitute a mistake. How do you know Warren Buffett wasn't repositioning his portfolio at that time, buying more of the great businesses that he wanted to own while they were on sale? because from March from I believe it's March of 2000, Matt, through I'm going to get my numbers a little bit off because I can't remember. Someone in my office did it yesterday. It was either the end of 17 or up until now. The S&P 500 is up just under 100%. Okay, in that time frame, Warren Buffett's up over 400 in the same time frame. Loses 38% while the S&P's up 28. Implied in the article, he may or may not be stating it, that Buffett makes mistakes just like the rest of us. Yes, he does. We all make investing mistakes. What I don't know, is he implying the 38% is a mistake? I wouldn't say that, because first of all, it's less than 2 years. If you're a long-term investor, that should be a minimum of 7 to 10 years in a time horizon. Let me give you another interesting statistic, Matt.
Okay.
30, 40, 50 years ago, the average holding period of an individual stock was 8 years. Today, it's 8 months. The average holding period of a mutual U.S. equity mutual fund in 2016 was 4.1 years. 2017, it was 3.8 years. And people call themselves, quote, long-term investors. I fundamentally believe investors have no idea what's going on with their money. And it leads to these biases that force them to make poorly made decisions that could potentially dramatically inhibit their ability to be successful as an investor over time. It's a simple formula. Warren Buffett buys great businesses, uses volatility to buy more of them, and holds on to them long term. He's not secretive about this.
Right.
But what Warren Buffett does is he sticks to the knitting because he has a process, he has a time-tested process of investing in great businesses over time.
But you're fighting this uphill battle against all of these biases when
yes.
investors call and they say, what's going on right now? And
yes.
right now doesn't
yes.
necessarily matter.
We have an advisor in my office today, literally sent me an email. One of his clients wants to get his returns for each year over the last 5 years, I think it was, I either said monthly or quarterly. I can't remember. People are looking at short-term windows, and they're comparing their portfolio to the S&P 500 because you have the media bias, you have the mental accounting, you have the narrow framing, you have basically a herding. I mean, all the biases, we get them all the time. I'll be blunt. How do we handle it? We tell people that long-term investing means greater than 1 year, 2 year, 3 years. Actually, it means 7 to 10 plus years in your portfolio. And number one. Number two, you can't compare your portfolio to the S&P 500 because your portfolio is not invested like the S&P 500. If your portfolio is not invested like the S&P 500, why would you compare it to the S&P 500? And of course, many of your investors' response, of course, which is this idea of herding, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I had a guy 2 weeks ago say, why wouldn't we just put all our money in the U.S. and let the horses run because it's doing the best right now?
Mm.
I mean, that does not have common sense, right? And that's what a lot of people do. And that's what people did in 1998. And the rest is history.
Mm-hmm.
The rest is history. This is what happens. This herding mentality. By the way, just so you know, at the peak of the market in 1999 or 2000, when the market peaked and then went through its long-term pullback, secular bear market, they call it, the S&P was trading at 29 times forward earnings. And the historical average at a peak of a secular bull market, Matt, is 25 times earnings. And everybody's whining about how overpriced the market is right now. The S&P 500 is right now trading at less than 17 times next year's earnings. And everybody is freaking out because people are saying the market's overvalued, the market's overvalued, the market's overvalued. The market will not become overvalued until more people, like lemmings, fall into the S&P 500 index, forcing the index valuation to 25 to 30 times earnings, just like it did in 1998 and 1999, only to crash and burn. By the way, over 80% at that peak, at 29 times earnings, over 80% of the S&P's performance was coming from 8 stocks. In 2018, as of the end of June, over 50% of the S&P 500's returns this year came from 4 stocks. I don't know. seems to me that would be kind of important to know, don't you think?
Important to know. And also that goes back to the allocation, diversification, knowing what you own and knowing what's in the S&P. People don't seem to understand what's in the S&P and how what is in the S&P affects the S&P rates of returns. How do you help educate people on that? So educate our listeners on that. Those numbers that you just gave are shocking. And I don't think people really get that the S&P growth, and I'm air quoting there, just came from such a small part. Explain.
Yep. Well, the number one, again, I have long said and believe part of the reason why the company of Nepsis is named Nepsis is because I believe in this importance of clarity, right? You work hard for your money, right? Doesn't it stand the reason you want every advantage you can possibly get in your favor? I've asked this question on the podcast before, right? And of course, many people say, well, yeah, of course, it's the more information I have, the better off I am. But let me give you, and I'm going to answer your question, but let me give you an interesting statistic. You know, if I said to you, hey, what do you think about investing in a company, Matt, that is trading at a forward price to earnings ratio of 77.46, the S&P is trading at 17, right? And, you know, the growth rate's pretty good. I mean, the growth rate's got, you know, probably in the they're growing their earnings probably in the neighborhood of, you know, 15, 20% per year, which is, you know, pretty good growth, right? And actually maybe even could be as high as 35, 40%, but it's trading at 77 times forward earnings. Would you think that would be a good buy right now? I would tell you that most people probably tell you no.
Mm-hmm.
Yet that's Amazon. Now, if I told you it was Amazon, you would go, oh, I like Amazon. Because there's a bias to Amazon, right? And valuations over short periods of time in companies are not necessarily always logical. And many people, if you didn't tell them it was Amazon, would say, it's too expensive. I wouldn't buy a stock like that. Yet Amazon has made a significant impact on the S&P 500's returns over the short term. So the ability to know what you own and why you own it gives you greater clarity in helping you make decisions in accomplishing your long-term goals. So how do we change the thinking of investors? I've often said we want to be an industry disruptor. And I don't even really think it's an industry disruption as much to say we want to be the industry's source of common sense, which is what I think Warren Buffett is. It's this idea that successful investing, wealth creation, comes from investing in great businesses over time, and that volatility creates the opportunity to buy more on sale. The problem, Matt, as you know, is that most investors do not have two very important behavioral components to help them do that, and that's flexibility and transparency. They don't have the flexibility to take advantage of things because they're in mutual funds and ETFs, and they don't have the transparency knowing what they own, why they own it, and what is causing my portfolio to do what it's doing at that time. It's common sense.
So with that common sense approach, I believe you are an industry disruptor, even though that the number one investor ever is you're doing the same ideas that he is, which seems strange why then you would still be a disruptor and there wouldn't be more people hitching their wagon to this. But big picture, okay, when you look at overcoming that objection, so the advisors that are listening to the podcast right now and they hear everything that you're saying and they're still sitting there and saying, Mark, you know what, man, I still have these clients who come in and say this same tripe that I'm hearing over and over again. You are a master at all of this. If I was looking to you for guidance, how would you shake somebody gently or not so gently,
right,
and wake them up?
So it's a great question. Advisors won't like my answer. You know, it's like I told this advisor today. It's a $1.5 million portfolio. It's a big portfolio. The client has shown behavioral tendencies to ask the same questions. Clearly, this investor, this client, does not read the quarterly updates and the content provided to him by Nepsis, by his financial advisor. He doesn't. He doesn't pay attention. And I have a long-standing relationship, a very good friend of mine, who is a mentor of mine, dating back to when I was in college. And one of the things he taught me about business is, and it's still with me today, Matt, and it is the cornerstone to the answer of your question. Not all meat is good meat. There's hamburger and there's filet. I personally enjoy a great glass of cab with a filet much more than a hamburger. And one of the things I tell financial advisors is you have to run your business like a gardener prunes his garden. There's always pruning. You're always getting rid of the bad branches to make room for the good branches. And I am not Pollyannic enough. I am not confident enough, or shall I say cocky enough, to say that everybody should believe what I'm saying. Not everybody's going to. That's fine. Go do it your own way. But don't come crying to me when things don't go well on the other side and you come back to me and say, gee, I wish I would have listened to you, because that's happened multiple times. And, you know, at the end of the day, financial advisors have to decide what's more important to them. Are they going to waste their time on the phone trying to convince somebody of something they're not going to convince them of? Or do they say, move on, and I'm going to go find new clients? Ultimately, that's really what has to happen, Matt. But a lot of financial advisors aren't willing to do that.
Hmm.
I hate to call a spade a spade.
Well, you know what? I think it's important for people to hear that. I know that there are a lot of advisors who hold on so tightly to people who don't truly get what they do, and it makes their lives miserable. And it makes, you know, the client's life miserable. It's just not a good fit. There are than enough people out there.
Yeah. Well, look, I get it. I mean, advisors care about their clients, right? And advisors have a belief system in their own head about how things should be done. And whether that's right or wrong, good or bad, I'm not here to say or judge. But what I would say is that if the advisor cares about the client, they don't want to see the client make mistakes. I haven't wanted to see clients make mistakes. I had my second or third client I ever got in my office the other day. I still have my first three clients, incidentally, and two of the three. I think one of them's deceased. Anyway, and both of them, particularly the first one, came to me and said, "We can't believe how much money we have." And they said, "How'd that happen?" And I said, "Well, it's very, very, very easy to understand. You don't follow the financial news and listen to all the noise that goes on in the market. You listen to your advisor, and you've done everything I've told you to do, and thus you've had great success." And I think that it's not, Matt, because I'm smart. It really isn't. I do have common sense, but most importantly, I have the ability to stick to the knitting. I believe in the process of how we manage money, why we make the decisions we make, and I believe that it is an industry change. It used to be this way, but it's not. And I do have a very passionate goal of, to use the biblical term, to once again teach people how to fish. And that's what we're going to do.
All right. Closing statements.
Buy low, sell high.
That's a great closing statement. I don't think we could get one more powerful than that. Goodness gracious. So
do not have biases. Stick to the investment process. Know your investment process. If you don't know what your investment process is, if you don't know how decisions are made, ask your advisor.
Okay. Awesome. They might not like what they hear, but if they don't, then guess what? They can go to the Napsis website and hopefully find out how they can connect with somebody like you. Actually, would you mind? We haven't talked about that in a while. What is the process for somebody who might want to explore your business?
Well, thanks for asking. They can go to www.investwithclarity.com. Super easy to remember. investwithclarity.com. Click on the Let's Talk, fill out the info, and someone will call you.
Got it. All right. With that, for everybody at Nepsis, if you have not subscribed to the podcast yet, make sure you click that subscribe now button below and go to Nepsis.com to make sure that you get information. It's a great place to get information. Subscribe to the podcast, listen to the radio show, and do whatever you can to make sure that you know what you own and why you own it. And if your advisor is unable to answer those questions, well, then that probably should make you rethink what advisor you're working with. So for everybody at Nepsis, this is Matt Hallern, and we'll see you on the other side of the mic very soon.
The content discussed is for informational purposes only. It is not a solicitation or recommendation for any securities that may be mentioned herein. Advisory services offered through Nepsis, Inc., an SEC-registered investment advisor.